I didn't time this, so I don't know how long it's going to take.
How long?
Couple things. First, I think we'll open with a couple of peripheral thoughts, as well as some disclaimers.
Alright.
First, we'll give the title of our discourse. Initially, it was just going to be simply divorce and remarriage. But instead, we added a word which we think is more important and draws its focus a little more tightly. So we're actually going to call this Christian divorce and remarriage. And there's a big difference between even that which was given to the Jew for reasoning for divorce and that which Jesus cites in various Gospels as far as the qualifying reasons for marriage and divorce and remarriage. However, we want to give out a couple disclaimers here if we can initially because being taped and just in case this tape reaches ears outside of our fellowship, I want to be upfront. Number one, I am a deacon. I'm not an elder. And obviously, the discourse should be given the proportional weight that it deserves based upon that fact. And we're not here in that capacity as far as a teacher is concerned. This is a pre-assigned discourse that was given months ago. The topic of which is left up to the discretion of the deacon. Second, I would rather not be the one giving this discourse myself. I'd much rather hear it, say, from the platform at a convention by elders. It's a somber topic, one that I think has a lot of teeth to it, simply because, unfortunately, leads us to another point. This is in our midst, and it's shocking. We say that we're in the truth, and we say we have the truth, and we have probably a deeper understanding of the scriptures as a whole, the plan of God, prophetic matters, than any group of associated brethren throughout the world. And the fact that we err, or what would appear to be erring, in such great numbers, shocking numbers, that how we can fall on these little points that are spelled out clearly in Scripture. They're not ambiguous, we don't believe. That we find this as a distressing, but we suppose that in light of the Job Scriptures, rather, I'm sorry, the Jude Scriptures and others that speak about those who many will, in the last days, will walk after their own lusts and scoffers. We're not assigning these to any particular individuals, but it should be no surprise that these matters have leavened our fellowship to the extent that they have, but it's disturbing nonetheless. The real crux of the issue here is not whether adultery is good or bad. I think everyone, at least in their definition or description of whether adultery is right or wrong, would agree that it's wrong. And we find the mention of adultery first in Exodus chapter 21. And it's simply given as one of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Period. It's a foundation law. It's not something that's woven into the intricacies of the law later on in Leviticus. This is something that's given by Jehovah right up front as one of the cardinal sins, if you want to call it that. Thou shalt not commit adultery. In Leviticus 20:10, we find out what the penalty for adultery is. We'll turn there and we'll read that scripture. Leviticus 20:10. Excuse me, I have butterfingers. And the man that committeth adultery with another man's wife, even he that committeth adultery with his neighbor's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. The scriptures are replete from Genesis to Revelation that adultery is a death sentence. If we look in Matthew chapter 5, if we can turn to Matthew chapter 5, that's where we'll actually begin with the crux of the matter of divorce and remarriage. Beginning with 17, we see that in context, which is very important, the context of this clearly states, where Jesus is speaking here, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law, till all be fulfilled. Whosoever therefore shall break one of the least of these commandments, and teach men, and shall teach men so, he shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." And he goes on talking that, speaking that we need to have an actual righteousness, a real outward living righteousness that exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees. And the scribes and the Pharisees outwardly were very righteous. They were focused on the letter of the law so closely that every part of their conduct, the way they dressed, the way they walked, the way they talked, the things they did, was based upon this strict legal code that they had built upon, not just the law, but also the Talmud and what later on the expounding of the law by these great Jewish philosophers, if you want to call it. So the outwardly, they had a very, let's say, at least an appearance of a high degree of righteousness, even though we find that it was feigned and it was according to, let's say, a false legal structure. But the issue is that the righteousness is required even for the Christian, that this is something that is not to be sloughed off as though all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. We know that Jesus tells us, "Be thou perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." The crux of the matter of this discourse is divorce and remarriage for the Christian. What has generated a considerable amount of, let's say, dissenting opinions, not just amongst the brethren, but amongst Christendom as a whole, there are multiple viewpoints on this issue. Three or four that have what would seem to be sufficient scriptural weight, at least to give them, lend them credence. There are a few different viewpoints. We'll go into it briefly. The first is the Catholic viewpoint, as in Roman Catholic. And we have to admit and be upfront here that we're not sure ourselves. I'm not sure myself which is the right viewpoint as far as the eligibility for one to remarry. At this point, I have not decided for my own self whether there is no remarriage period, except in the death of the spouse, for the consecrated believer, or whether the innocent party of an adulterous, or one who is, was committed adultery against, is eligible for remarriage. There are strong arguments both ways. We won't present that here today. What we will present is that we feel the scriptures in no wise teach that the guilty party, the adulterer or the adulteress, is eligible in God's eyes to remarry. And we should add that the most important part is, does the church have authority to act on this in any way? Does the church have the ability to impose any, whether it be disfellowship, sanctions, requirements that need to be fulfilled on behalf of a consecrated brother or sister as far as their repentance and restoration in the church is concerned? With that, we'll begin with Deuteronomy chapter 24. Beginning with verse 1. "When a man hath taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes, because he hath found some uncleanness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorcement, and give it in her hand, and send her out of his house. And when she is departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife. And if the latter husband hate her, and write her a bill of divorcement, and give it in her hand, and send it her out of her house, or if the latter husband die, which took her to be his wife, her former husband, which sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife. After that she is defiled. For that is abomination before the Lord. And it goes on. There's no question that the Jews were given the option to divorce practically for any reason, what it amounts to. There really is not a specific line of thought that you can peg down in these verses, whether it's in the Hebrew or not, that certain criteria need to be met. It needs to be stressed that this verse, or these verses in Deuteronomy, sanctioning divorcement, which, by the way, the Hebrew word for divorce is used only 3 times in the entire Old Testament. It's used here in Deuteronomy. It's used in Jeremiah when prophesying of the divorce from the 10-tribe kingdom Israel, and in Isaiah 50 verse 1, prophesying about the divorce of Jehovah from the 2-tribe kingdom. In Malachi 2:16, it says, in the King James Version, God hates divorce. That word is not the same word that's used. It's actually a different word. The word used in Malachi 2:16 is a word that's used thousands of times in the Old Testament, and it actually means put away, not divorce. So not a bill or a writ of divorcement. It opens up a line of thought or thinking that Jesus, in the chapters we're going to read, or the verses we're going to read in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, is not talking about the bill of divorcement, the writ of divorcement, but the putting away, because likewise, Jesus does not use the word for divorce in the Greek, which is apostasis, almost like apostasy, if you want to call it that. That's the word that's actually used for divorce in the New Testament. He uses a different Greek word, which again means putting away. So the same thing that God hates, Jehovah hates in Malachi, the putting away of the spouse, is the same thing that Jesus is referring to in the New Testament, because he does not use the Greek word for divorcement. However, we do not, or we are not asserting, the thought that divorce is still legal in Jesus' eyes. We think you can argue the point that divorce is putting away. You can put your wife or your husband, in the case of the Jews, it was strictly granted to the men. It was not granted to the women to divorce. That changed in Jesus' day, and we'll find out in subsequent scriptures, but it changed for a reason, and we'll get into that in a moment. However, with regard to putting away versus divorce, a man can put away his wife without divorcing her, but he cannot divorce her without putting her away. There was a common practice in Israel that men would put away their wives, which caused them to sin, in essence causing them to commit adultery, without going through the writ of divorcement process. Because the writ of divorcement wasn't just give her a piece of paper and send her on her way. It was give her a piece of paper, the dowry and everything that she came into the marriage with had to be returned, refunded to her. That was a considerable portion of their estate in many cases. It was also a hassle. You had to go to a judge and actually have it ratified or certified. You just couldn't say, here's a piece of paper, hit the street. It wasn't like that at all. The Jews were very meticulous about it, and it was hit or miss whether or not the divorce would be granted, like it was even in this country up until certain years ago, when the policies of no-fault divorce, quote-unquote, became popular. So it was not just a walk in the park. If the man decided she's not pretty anymore, she can't cook well, whatever the case might be, he could sue for divorce, but not always get it. However, by putting her away, it was a common, almost accepted practice by the Jews during even Moses' time. And we'll look at this also because for two things. One, the law was given right at the beginning of the Exodus. Deuteronomy was written about 40 years later, right at the end of the Exodus. So a considerable period of time was given between the giving of the law and Moses issuing this ability for writ of divorcement. The problem is that divorce is not a new thing. to the Jews. Divorce was common in Egypt. Where did the Jews come from? They went in, basically, as Jacob and his sons into Egypt, lived there for centuries. So in a very real sense, the Jewish nation was not yet born. For all practical purposes, for most of their existence in Egypt, they were Egyptians. They were imprinted by Egyptian culture, Egyptian laws. The law wasn't given at that point. They still had an identity, obviously, because when Ramses came into power and enslaved the Jews, it was probably more along racial lines than it was anything else. So they naturally, they did have some identity, some separation, but they were homogenized, for lack of a better word, with the Egyptians and were very Egyptian-oriented in their thinking and whatnot. When they came out of Egypt and were walked the land for 40 years, when everyone beyond the age of 20 and within that certain age bracket died, then they became very much an individual people because they were given the law, they went through tremendous trials and difficulties. Most of the population had cycled over as far as the generations were concerned. So by the time they went into the land and occupied it, they were very much Israelites at that point. And they became their own people with their own law and setup. What changed was not too long, you know, after... Well, let's back up a little bit. First, let's cover a little bit of a different topic, though it's woven in. Polygamy is not adultery. Polygamy was legal in the Jewish law. You could have multiple wives. Exodus 21. You can read that for yourself. We know that there are many instances of polygamy that was not condemned. We know that, it says, Jehovah gave David his wives. Multiple wives. We know he had many of them. We know the names of a few of them. But he had many wives. Don't think for a moment that David was forgiven carte blanche for his trespass with Bathsheba. He paid a stiff penalty for that. And we're told that Jehovah covered his sin with Bathsheba and Uriah. So he had to lose a child. He suffered a great many things at the hands of his own children, himself, the treachery and whatnot. And subsequently, he was not permitted to build the temple, which was probably the nearest and dearest thing on his heart at that time. We can't use some of these exceptions to prove a rule, is what I'm really trying to say here. We can't take David and say, well, see here, the Lord sanctioned his marriages, because now we do understand that there's a difference between polygamy and adultery. Even in the New Testament, it can be argued that polygamy is allowed for the Christian convert. We look in Timothy, Paul writes to him that the qualifications for elder, husband of one wife, was not uncommon during the first advent, really, in many cultures, to have, including the Jewish culture, to have multiple wives. So the issue was you just couldn't hold an office. So through the proper channels, adultery really is the taking of someone else's spouse versus going through the proper channels and being married, even in a polygamous arrangement. That is not to say we condone polygamy at this time. We do understand that the spiritual, as well as the original definition of marriage between Adam and Eve, one man, one woman, the two shall be one flesh. There's no doubt about that. But there were provisions made for the Christian polygamist, the one who came in, who had multiple wives. And it was not considered adultery. Now with that, we'll get to Matthew 5. We've already read what we feel is the context here. Jesus is speaking to the multitude and his disciples, and he's clearly saying that he's not here to change the law. He's not here to change anything. He's here to fulfill, clarify, and enforce the law, as it were, especially with himself. He had to obey the law perfectly, and he could not even discuss broaching the law. Thanks, man. because that in and of itself would be a violation. So Jesus was not changing anything about the law. He was not changing the penalties that resulted as a violation of the law. And it's, he clarifies this right in the beginning here in Matthew with the, you know, he's not come to destroy the law, one jot, one tittle. Anyone that teaches men anything different than what are in the commandments. So to be clear, Jesus is not changing anything. In verse 21 of chapter 5, we begin, "Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time," which is, by the way, is not in the oldest manuscripts. It should just be, "Ye have heard that it was said, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. I say unto you, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, thou shalt be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire." We're not going to get into the intent behind what Jesus was saying. We feel we know that now Jesus is coming to put the cart, the horse before the cart, as it were, that it's heart obedience first, and from obedience in the heart stems the outward righteousness and obedience. However, what he is bringing in here, and in multiple succeeding scriptures, is hell fire, the word Gehenna, which pictures second death. Correct. It's interesting that the first mention of the penalty for adultery in the Old Testament is the death of the adulterer and the adulteress, both parties. Here, the first mention of adultery in the New Testament involves, in context, Gehenna, the second death. We are not saying unequivocally that there is no hope for one who commits adultery. We're not convinced at that point. We are convinced of a different point, which we may or may not bring up in the discourse today, because it might sound a little too judgmental. But, however, we do believe there is hope for recovery of an adulterer or an adulteress who is consecrated, and that they may get life. Verse 27, "Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath already committed adultery in his heart." So again, Jesus is raising the standard of the law to an internal application versus an external application that the scribes and Pharisees were famous for. The scribes actually say, if you read the Talmud, you can feel however you want. You can think however you want. You just can't do whatever you want. And that was an actual teaching. You can lust after her. You can want to kill your brother. But as long as you don't do it, you're obedient to the law. Jesus is changing that thinking with the disciples. And we find out later that his words are not easy for people to understand. He says, "He that hear, let him hear, and let him apply it." But it's not, it's going to be difficult for most people. Verse 31, "It hath been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement." This is a gloss over difference. There are two thoughts here, the putting away and the divorcing. The, both of the words are used in this one instance that Jesus is quoting here. The put away is the apoluso, and the divorcement is the apostasis, the apostasy, if you want to call it that. "But I say unto you, that whosoever shall put away, apoluso, his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery. And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery." Jesus makes a very similar but slightly different statement in Matthew 19. And it's this particular instance is recorded differently in both Mark and Luke, which gives us, we think, a more clear overall picture of, it fills in the blanks, as it were, of the Matthew account. He doesn't go on here because this is not the instance. There are two different instances. Here he's just addressing his disciples. In the other accounts, he's actually addressing scribes and Pharisees that come to try him, as it were, tempt him. The issue is there are two schools of thought at Jesus' time. We'll back up a bit. We'll fill this in simply because this discourse was precipitated by a series of events that have happened within the last month. And a dialogue we've been having between some different ecclesias and individual brethren in the New England area. And there's a thought or line of thinking, we should say, that's being taught that it is all right for the guilty party, the adulterer or adulteress, to remarry, that it is recognized and sanctioned by God. Not that adultery is. We have to be clear. We don't want to impugn anyone's motives, number one, and say something wrong that may give somebody the wrong idea about someone else that we don't want to do. We won't mention any names specifically. But there is an issue where a sister, and there are plenty of them, so it's not, these are universal principles that are applicable to the church, but it's a specific issue at hand that has prompted or has been a catalyst for our thinking and the discourse today. And what that is, many of you are already familiar with, but there was a sister, both sister and brother were consecrated, sister commits adultery, divorce ensues on scriptural grounds, the sister has since remarried, and is a participating member, as well as her husband, of an ecclesia. There are those who are teaching from the platform that God recognizes this marriage, God forgives the adulterer, not that adultery is right, and not that there is not some future ethereal penalty, let's say, that they'll pay when they face God in heaven. But just that there is no authority on the church's part to take any action whatsoever because their marriage here on this side of the veil is recognized, and we should all recognize it because they feel that's what the scriptures teach. And it's based upon Deuteronomy 24, and the words that Jesus speaks in the four verses, that we have in the two instances in Matthew, the one in Mark, and the one in Luke. However, the Deuteronomy scriptures are very clear that it's not for adultery, because the penalty for adultery was death. That penalty, by the way, was effective for just a fairly short period of time. It really wasn't carried out. It's sort of like, if you want to call it, our death penalty here, that there are literally tens of thousands, I don't remember what the number is, I think it's over 100,000 people in our country on death row. And there are fewer than 100 executed every year, which means that they're all going to die of old age on death row long before the penalty is ever executed. It was much like that in Old Testament times, and it's much like that today in modern Israel. Modern Israel today, at Jesus' second advent, was very much, or is very much, like modern Israel, or Israel was at Jesus' first advent, as far as this cosmopolitan thinking, this international influence that's imprinted itself upon Israel. At the first advent, you have to remember, Israel had been a vassal state for 600 years, for six centuries. They had been under the control of the Babylonians. Millions of people were in Israel when it was constituted of the 12 contiguous tribes. The Assyrian captivity wiped out most of the population. They never came back. the ten tribe kingdom never came back. They were dispersed. It was a diaspora. They never again reassembled and came back in any number or quantity. However, with the Babylonian captivity, there were hundreds of thousands in Jerusalem and in the surrounding area. Out of that population, only 4,000 went into captivity into Babylon. They were there, that 4,000 was there for 70 years. They were told to plant trees, not shrubs, but trees, which take considerable time to grow, and to buy houses and to basically live their lives. The prophecy was given, Jeremiah told them. Out of that, they prospered throughout the Babylonian captivity. They were treated rather fairly. And about 50,000 after Cyrus's decree allowed them to go back into the lands, only about 50,000 of them returned. And by this time, they were very much contaminated, defiled, if you want to call it that, by Babylonian thinking on a number of subjects. And this is historically provable. However, the one thing that they were completely cured of was idolatry. They did not have idols in any to any great measure or anything after that. And that was the primary reason for their captivity to begin with. They played the harlot and went after other gods. Subsequent to that, of course, they were a vassal state of Media and Persia. Subsequent to that, by the Greco-Roman empires. The Greco-Roman empires really made Israel, or turned Israel into this heterogeneous mixture of cultures. There were a number of different lines of thought. They had really, the religious was separated from the civil, where before Israel was meant to be a theocratic government, a theocracy. They were meant to be ruled by the laws that were given to Moses by Jehovah. He's the one who formed their society and gave them the pattern of which they should conduct their business on a day-to-day level. That was completely divided, especially by the time of the first advent. When Jesus was on the scene, Herod was king. He was married to his brother's wife, Herodias, which is another issue we'll get into, that John was speaking out against this unlawful union of Herod and Herodias according to the law. It was not lawful for them to be married because it was an adulterous situation, we're told, clearly, flat out. He was committing adultery, which should raise some flags in our thinking right then and there as well. And that was, even with, John certainly knew that there were writs of divorcement, that under the proper conditions, remarriage was okay, when adultery was not involved. Now the key here is, in the Old Testament, adultery being at least the penalty, we're going to stick with not whether or not it was exercised all the time, not whether or not there were exceptions to the rule. We're going to stick with, in a sense, the letter of the Jewish law, and we're going to try to do our best to stick with and see how this translates, how Jesus is not changing anything in his thinking when he says that from the beginning it was not so. And that's the critical point. And I think from there we can discern the right or the propriety of, number one, the guilty party's eligibility to remarry, and number two, whether or not the church has any authority to deal with the matter directly. We'll go to Matthew 19. Beginning with verse 3. The Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him, saying unto him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? Now, again, back to this, the thinking of the day that was pervasive. There were two camps. One, we would probably identify ourselves more with, if we were living at that time, Hillel and Shimei were the two leaders of the Sanhedrin at the time, and they were the ones most, more or less, most responsible for the thinking that permeated the Jewish concepts of the day and interpretation of various laws. Hillel was, for lack of a better word, a liberal who said that divorce was permissible for any reason. You can divorce your wife, remarry, doesn't matter what. I mean, she can look at you funny and you can just go ahead and divorce her. Shimei was more conservative in the fact that you needed serious grounds or adultery to remarry. Now, the reason in the law that remarriage of the guilty party was not allowed is because the guilty party was dead. They couldn't obviously remarry. And that freed, the death of a spouse frees a party from the marriage vow or the marriage contract. They're free to remarry. So in a very practical, pragmatic way, adultery, according to the law, did not allow the guilty party to remarry and set at liberty or set free the innocent party. Additionally, there was no divorce involved. You can't find anywhere in the scriptures that talk about divorcing an adulterer or an adulteress. It doesn't exist. So that just basically, if you want to, we might call it an annulment or complete nullification of the vows. There was no writ of divorcement because divorce set both parties free. Adultery did not set the guilty party free in the Old Testament. Divorce did. That's a key distinction, and it's important to keep that in mind. Adultery is not grounds for divorce in the strict definition of Deuteronomy 24. Different word entirely. Jesus now is bringing this to a contemporary point in his first advent. This was a big debate that was going on along with many, many others, countless other debates that were going on between the scribes and the Pharisees. As we know, Paul took advantage of one of those debates when the Sadducees didn't believe in a resurrection. And the Pharisees did. Just get them talking amongst themselves, and the rest will take care of itself. And and to this very day, even, that carries on to the natural Jew in Israel on the Sabbath. Many buildings, their elevators are automated, so they don't have to work to push a button on the Sabbath day. How ridiculous is that? That's how minute and how picayune the Jews get into the law. I mean, they get into such minute, ridiculous detail that Jesus condemns that thinking. You strain at the gnat and you swallow a camel. If you're looking at that, Brother Russ gave a discourse about it some time ago, analysis paralysis, that you can paralyze yourself by overanalyzing something. And believe it or not, I sort of succumbed to that in the preparation for this discourse, because there are a couple of lines of thought that, in all honesty, I'm not persuaded which one is the more appropriate one. However, I am persuaded, and I think we can scripturally prove that today, that the person that is guilty of adultery does not have the scriptural grounds or right to remarry, and that the church, because of such an act, has not only a right to exercise authority that it's been given in such instances, but has the responsibility to do so for the leavening of the flock, number one, to remove that influence as promptly as possible, or at least get it corrected, and number two, for the salvation of the one that's involved, because if the church is teaching that this type of behavior is scriptural and moral, but in reality, it's making them culpable or liable to Gehenna, the second death, if persisted in, it is our imperative, our moral and brotherly or sisterly imperative, to do all we can to protect the flock from the leavening influences, and this would fall directly on the shoulders of the elders. They're the ones who are responsible. And it does not, by any stretch of the imagination, well, our elder agrees with it, so therefore we're absolved of any responsibility. it certainly does fall into, and that's why we're giving this discourse, even though we would rather not be the ones giving it, that it falls onto each one of us, that eventually the church is going to become so, for lack of a better word, defiled, polluted, at the very end of the age, simply because of a very pragmatic or practical matter, that as the little flock goes beyond the veil, there are fewer and fewer left behind to instruct the remainder of the consecrated brethren that will ultimately comprise the great company. So in reality, just by the sheer majority of the sheer numbers and the sheer lack of the salt in the earth, the great company, or the thinking of the great company, which is generally injurious on many levels, will permeate or pervade even the brotherhood. The pastor, though he did not speak on it directly many times, we believe through his writings that we have read, both in the sixth volume and in a couple of different reprint articles, we believe that we're in harmony with him on this teaching as well. So Matthew 19, we've read verse 3, where the Pharisees come tempting him, asking if it's lawful for a man to put away his wife, which is interesting. Again, that's apuolo or apulo. I'm sorry, I don't have it written down in front of me, but it's not the Greek word for divorce. That's a big, big difference, which really I think you can form a thinking that they're not asking Jesus here, and there is a line of thought along this line out there, that they're not asking Jesus if it's lawful for someone to divorce their spouse, but whether it's lawful for them to just unilaterally put them away. They do not use the Greek word for divorce here, the apostasis. And Jesus answers them and says, "Have ye not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and the twain shall be one flesh." That was established at creation. I mean, we don't see that Adam took more wives. You can't find that in Genesis. The same thing, basically, really, of course, fallen angels accepted, Noah and his sons. Noah, his wife, and their sons and the sons' wives, eight souls, so if you add them up, that means that Shem, Ham, and Japheth only had one wife each. That persisted, apparently, all the way through the flood. And that union of one man, one woman, the twain shall be one flesh, was preserved in Noah and his sons. It wasn't until subsequent to that that this thought of the polygamal or arrangement or whatever, and in the sense that concubines weren't outlawed. We know the kings had them. Many things before the law came along were permissible, and we're told that God winked the eye at many of these things. Some for reasons because of just ignorance on man's part, and others for very practical reasons. Incest is not permitted in the law. You can't marry your sister. Well, I'm sorry, but Cain and Abel and Adam and Eve's subsequent children, they had to be married to their siblings, their first generation sisters and brothers. I mean, you can't work out the population of the earth any other way. So, and we can get into the genetics of it and all that, but that's a distraction. But needless to say, there are some things that were permitted in the Old Testament. There are sometimes we have exceptions, but again, drawing it back to a tighter focus here, the words of the law in its specifics, whether they were carried out or not, does not matter. And the words of Jesus in their specifics are what we need to focus on to ascertain whether or not, again, their eligibility for remarriage on someone's part, especially, or I should say specifically, in the cause of or case of adultery. Verse 5, and said, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, the twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. God joined, God instituted the thought of the two becoming one flesh, that we now call marriage, that man cannot put asunder. And we find out here in verse 7, why did Moses, a man, then command to give a writing of divorcement? Now that's the apostasis. Here they're trying to trick him by using their, that it wouldn't otherwise be to put her away. So now they're bringing the two in. The putting away was not lawful, was never lawful. The divorcing was, we find out here, and he saith unto them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, suffered you to put away your wives. It's interesting, hardness of your hearts. We've all heard of arterial sclerosis. It's a medical term, which means what? Hardening of the arteries. That's the medical term. The Greek word for hardening the heart? Sclerocardia. Cardial sclerosis. So in a very real sense, that it's a, you know, I just thought it was interesting that we take so many words from the Greek and the Latin, and we look at them and we find out that many of them have an interesting translation here in the scriptures. But from the beginning, it was not so. So we find here that Jesus is, if you want to say, for lack of a better word, lumping the two, the putting away and the divorcement together. He's addressing them together because he's saying here, Moses didn't give a writ of putting away. He gave a writ of divorcement. And that, if we remember in Ezra, when the Jews were told to put away their foreign wives, that and their children, it was not divorce, because it was never marriage to begin with, never a legal marriage. He says wives, you know, put away your wives, but actually that word can be wives or woman or whatever. Basically, put away, get rid, just put them out, get rid of them. The foreign women you took, as well as the children that were born by them, because they're illegitimate. They were bastards in the scriptural sense of the word, the King James scriptural sense of the word, I should say. And we know that the bastards, these illegitimate people, weren't allowed in the congregation. It says specifically that these illegitimate children are not allowed in the congregation of Israel. He saith unto them, and I should say that, and I think in either Mark or Luke, the word is properly rendered. The word for and is the Greek word day, de. It can actually be but, you know, and whatever. It can have a number of different connotations. And I think the word but fits a little better here. But I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. So Jesus doesn't use the word for divorce here. He's just talking about putting away. So I think he's covering all aspects of it. Both the putting away practice, which was prevalent and popular almost throughout Jewish history, but specifically at the time of Jesus, simply because, again, of this like heterogeneous influx of all these different cultures that had worked on Israel for 600 years since the Babylonian captivity, and certainly the pagan, if you want to call it democratic way of thinking that had been introduced by the Greco-Roman world. And we find that, I think he has this here, just scan this real quickly. No, it must be in a, it's probably in Luke, sorry about that. But we do find that in the other verses in Luke that he says that the woman who puts away her husband, that basically she's guilty of the same thing. In the Jewish law, that was not a possibility. Strictly speaking, the Jews, this writ of divorcement, could only be initiated or instituted by the husband. However, by the time of Jesus' first advent, the equality of women, the social structure or fabric was very much like it is today in our society, or in Western society, where the gap between men and women still exists, but it's the women have rights, the same basic rights that the men do. So a woman can initiate a divorce just as easily as a man can in our culture, and that was the same thing back in Jesus' day. That existed. And Jesus' mere discussion of it or talking about it, that if a woman does it too, that she's guilty, that it's probably providential in one sense, because it would be covering the future Christian church that would go out to the Gentiles, and the Gentile world is generally, you know, much more, you know, if you want to call it eclectic or whatever. But here he's saying that whosoever shall put away his wife, that apuluso or apulolo or whatever it is, except it be for fornication. That word fornication is not adultery. The word fornication here in the Greek is porneia. It's not the word like morikai, I think, is the Greek word for adultery. He doesn't say for adultery here. He says for basically for could be lewd conduct. Could be they don't have to commit adultery in order for a husband to put away his wife, or something, you know, by extrapolation, a wife to put away her husband. It can be for other reasons other than strict fleshly adultery. However, it kind of opens up a little can of worms, because it can also be used as, if you want to call it, abused, I should say, as an escape clause. That there's no doubt that a consecrated, even in a consecrated home, and I'm sure it's happened many times, I'm sure it's going on right at this very moment, that a spouse can do everything in their power to make it uncomfortable for their husband or wife in an effort to free themselves from the marriage. Unfortunately, we happen to know of a situation, and that's just happened recently. You know, I mean, I know some of you here are familiar with it, but someone who, because of what I would consider to be an improper, dangerous teaching, we know of a spouse who specifically went out and committed adultery on the other spouse for the very cause of getting a divorce, because the other spouse said, I will not grant you a divorce, except on scriptural grounds. So this particular spouse went out and gave them the reason for the divorce, you know, went on scriptural grounds that the other one felt. So, and this is the brotherhood. That's the amazing part. That this type of behavior, the reason I think a big part of it's turning to such a problem here, an issue with the brethren, is because it's almost not dealt with. It's not that it's being dealt with improperly, or it's being handled, or people are taking stands. It's just almost like we're lulled into, we're hypnotized by it, and we stand there and do nothing, and it becomes so intransigent over time that it's almost impossible to extricate, because it's affected so many different brethren in so many different areas on so many different levels, whether directly or indirectly. So back to Matthew 19. Whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. It's not the putting away, it's the marrying of another. He's not talking just about divorce bad. He's talking about remarriage improperly is adultery. Improper remarriage is adultery, period. Because he uses the word here, again, back to what we were saying with regard to the word porneia, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. Well, that's the word for adultery. So it's not, it's not as though Jesus is choosing, a word that means the same thing. It doesn't. He's actually using both words in the same structure, at least as far as every manuscript written supports. That so we get the thought here that again Jesus is pointing out that any improper divorce that results in remarriage of others to not being reconciled, to others outside of that marital arrangement is a results or eventuates in an adulterous arrangement. Now, admittedly, he says, marries her which is put away doth commit adultery. That's in the singular sense. Some will say, well, you can only commit adultery once and then you're free. Anytime you do it after that, it's not adultery anymore. I would submit, well, maybe it's not adultery in the strict sense of the, you know, the Jewish sense of the definition of the word, but it's porneia. It's fornication. So whether you're married by earthly standards or not. Now, this issue is, getting back to the law, the guilty party was legally obligated to be put to death. So they had no rights. They forfeited their rights. They forfeited their rights to the marriage. They forfeited their rights to life. And I don't think that is something that would be out of line to draw that conclusion over to the spiritual level, to the Christian age. Let's look at Mark. Chapter 10. I think this is where I'm at. Let's see. All right. Verses 1 through 12. We'll just sort of zip through them and paraphrase a little bit. Pharisees came to him. This is Mark's view of the same event that we read in Matthew 19. Pharisees came to him and asked him, is it lawful for man to put away, so we're confirmed there, his wife, tempting him? And he answered and said unto them, what did Moses command you? And they said, Moses suffered to write a bill of divorcement to put her away. That's not true. That Moses' bill of divorcement, I think if you read it, and we won't get into the nitty-gritty of it, but if you read it, was begrudgingly given in the event of some real non-adulterous issues that had arisen in the marriage. Back at this time, and basically throughout the history, certainly up to and including the First Advent, marriage was not like we have marriage today. We get married, and generally speaking, in our society, the wedding is consummated, or I'm sorry, the marriage is consummated, usually on the wedding night. It wasn't the case in the time of Jesus' first advent, or even almost any time leading up to that. It was not unusual for there to be a wedding, no consummation. And the husband would return and go back and build, get their home ready, get everything set up, and then send for his bride, and it could be a year. That was not uncommon. This is not unusual. It's foreign to our way of thinking, but it could be a year before that woman was actually, came into the house and the marriage was consummated. And this is why in the law we're told that if you were to fornicate with someone betrothed to another man, they were wed, but they had not consummated the marriage. Betrothed to another man, some of us might think that is
engagement.
Thank you. But it's not. That if you were betrothed and you fornicated with another man, married or not, you're both put to death. And it was treated as adultery. But it specifies it differently in Exodus, or Leviticus, rather, I should say. Unless, of course, it was a situation of rape. We're told the exception is made. The one who rapes her is put to death, but the victim is preserved. Not worthy of death, it says. So, again, back to what we were saying with regard to this time frame, this time period, it was very possible that there could be this infidelity prior to the consummation of the marriage arrangement. So, Ooh, wow. Okay. I'll try and wrap up, get onto the point here.
I just said 15 minutes, the phone's going to be ringing.
Okay. All right. What did Moses command you? Moses suffered, right? That's interesting. And they said Moses suffered to write a bill of divorcement and to put her away. Jesus answered and said unto them, for the hardness of your hearts, sclerocardia, he wrote you this precept, but from the beginning was not so. We've already, in a sense, read those and others. And he saith unto them, whosoever shall put away his wife and marry another committeth adultery against her. That's a plain statement. Doesn't bring up the, in the, you know, except for fornication, porneia. But I think you can assume that this is a whole, you know, that we take all the Gospels as a whole, and it fills in the, some of the blanks that are that exist in each one. And that ends there. Now, we'll get quickly here. We'll try and sum this up. Luke 16. Maybe not.
Verse 18?
18.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Thank you. All right, Luke 16, verse 18. Whosoever putteth away his wife and marrieth another committeth adultery, and whosoever marrieth her that is put away from her husband committeth adultery. There's a disconnect there, we think. We know that there are certain scriptures, certainly, we can prove it, that when just a comma, in a sense, can completely change or alter the thinking of the scripture. We'll give probably the most famous one. I say unto you this day, thou shalt be with me in paradise. Those in the nominal system, almost everyone, says, I say unto you this day, thou shalt be with me in paradise. And we, of course, feel that I say unto you this day, thou shalt be with me in paradise. And we feel that, obviously, the context bears that out, simply because Jesus was not in paradise with the thief that day. Although, those in the nominal system have a very sophisticated argument to deal with that, by the way. That's not our topic. However, we think that there is a bit of a disconnect here. Because remembering again that the Deuteronomy scriptures do not deal with adultery, the ones given for divorcement, remembering that putting away was a common practice outside of the actual law of divorcement, and we're told that God doesn't hate divorce in Malachi 2:16, which he certainly, I think on principle, does, but that he hates the putting away. He hated that practice that was common in Israel at that time. Here we think that we can read this a couple of different ways, and we don't think it's any less valid than reading it that reading it in the sense that let me see here. Back in the, the Matthew case. Let's see. Whoever put his away his wife from earth and another commit adultery. Back in the Matthew 19 scripture, where he gives the qualification of, except for fornication, for porneia. Make sure I got that here. There we are. Okay. 19:9, saying to you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, shall marry another, committeth adultery, and whoso marrieth her, which is put away, doth commit adultery. That you can look at that as a two-part sentence, just as someone who would say, well, this, in a sense, is saying the guilty party is now free. If the innocent party is free, the guilty party is free, because that's the definition of divorce. This isn't divorce, this is the putting away. Divorce nullifies the marriage. Adultery nullifies the marriage. There was no divorce for adultery. So therefore, drawing the same definition or meaning or structure of divorce over to the New Testament and the way Jesus was being tested, he's saying that here, this fornication, let's say the porneia, not just specifically for adultery, that negates, I'm not talking about adultery, because that, you know, in a sense, negates the marriage contract to begin with, according to the law, which he says just a few verses earlier. I'm sorry, actually in Matthew 5, he says, "I'm come to keep." Anyone who teaches anything different you know, is going to be least in the kingdom of heaven. So we know that Jesus is not changing a thing. He's not saying that adultery no longer carries the weight of the penalty of death. He could not say that. That would be impossible. He's not. That's not implied in any way, shape, or form in these scriptures. He's saying that the one you can put away your wife, put away. He's not saying divorce. He's saying you can put away your wife for fornication. That's lawful. It's not a divorce. Because it's a forfeit. The rights are forfeit. You don't need to go through the divorce process, the freeing process. It does not free them both. It frees the innocent party to put away, not to apostasis, divorce. But whosoever marries her, which is put away, apulo, not divorce, who is put away, doth commit adultery. That is the key, I think, the crux of the matter. And I'm not good with words. I'm not a wordsmith. I talk, but I'm just not good with words. So, you know, the definition of a genius is someone who can take something complex and make it simple. I can't do that. I don't have that ability. So I hope I'm putting forth the right thinking here, in that the understanding of this is key to show that the guilty party, they're not divorced. They're divorced by worldly standards. They're divorced by the cosmopolitan standards of the world, and they can be remarried by worldly standards in this quote-unquote no-fault divorce. But not in God's eyes. He does not allow the adulterer to remarry. And he's saying that the one who does remarry, the one put away, commits adultery. So there's culpability or guilt brought on even to the originally innocent party, that they're sucked into it. They're brought into it. It talks about the adulteress in the Old Testament, especially in Proverbs and Psalms. The adulteress like lays in wait at night to see, you know, she makes herself pretty, she dresses up to seduce the young men, to bring them in. Proverbs 27 says, he who commits adultery does so through lack of understanding, lack of knowledge, and destroys his own soul. So the ignorance doesn't spare you from destroying your own soul, certainly. Fortunately, we have the grace of Christ in the New Testament that there are provisions for recovery. There was no repentance from adultery in the law. It was cut and dry. It didn't matter. If you commit adultery, you're stoned. You're put to death. There was no, oh, I'm sorry, please, I'm contrite, tears, etc. That's all good, fine, great, we're glad you're sorry. Throw the stones. So, fortunately, we don't live in that time frame, and Jesus is not saying here that the law is null and void for adultery. What he is saying is that if you marry ineligibly, you are committing adultery. And it's so pervasive and common. And I say this not because I want to say this, not because I enjoy it. I would much rather it be more liberal. My flesh would, I should say. Let's put it that way. My father is on wife number 4. My mother is divorced from husband number 3. That's 7 marriages between them. I grew up thinking divorce was just a way of life. It's not something that, you know, I grew up necessarily hating divorce or anything like that. I don't have this preformed opinion. I just see this as what the scriptures clearly state. And if I have a problem with it, well, then it's my problem. It's not Jehovah's problem. It's not Jesus' problem. It's not flexible. I can't twist, bend, wrest the scriptures into saying something that they do not say. So it's important for us, and again, I say this as a deacon, I'm not an elder, I would say this from a position of authority or teaching, but I do think that the scriptures give us the authority as a church to deal with this issue quickly, number one. When it comes up, it's like, you ever see that little game where the woodchucks come out of the hole and you have a hammer and you have to bang them back in as soon as they pop up? That's what we should be doing with the sin. I mean, it's a crude illustration, but as soon as we see it, we don't just watch them pop up and, hey, you know, and we don't spill the leaven and say, oh, well, you know, it'll be okay, that type of thing. We need to, I think, in accord with the scriptures, particularly those of Paul, who outlined what we need to do, not directly in this instance, because we do have scriptures in Romans that say, And again, this leads into another thought, which I myself am struggling with this at this moment, of whether there's even really an eligibility for marriage of the innocent party for the one who leaves, because it says, you know, if your husband leaves, doesn't talk about adultery, but if your husband leave, you know, remain unmarried, remain single, basically, until he dies. And there are other scriptures, too, in 1 Corinthians. And, of course, again, we have Herod and Herodias, and there are a number of pictures, and we're over time, so I'll wrap up here. But the real issue is that the water's in the boat, as we see it right now. And the boat can be in the water, as we know. The water can't be in the boat. And the other thing, we want to give this in the spirit, in a proper spirit, we really do, because there's an old cliche. It says, it's easier to fight for one's principles than it is to live by them. So we don't say this from a high and lofty position. We don't say this as though thoughts, I wish I could say, but that thoughts have never entered our head, and that we're not in violation of you know, various principles or laws somewhere. But we say this, and we know that people don't believe something because they think it's wrong. But regardless of whether it's comfortable for us or not, and this is very uncomfortable, it needs to be dealt with. The scriptures are clear on it. And we do not have the liberty. Morally speaking, the scriptures are not morally ambiguous. They're not open to progressive interpretation. We need to act as a body in unison and not be derelict in our duty, not shirk our responsibilities. And for the good of the body and the individual, disfellowship or actions on behalf of the church, you know, these difficult actions are not something that we enjoy taking, but they need to be done nonetheless. And with that, we'll close.
Some comments or questions that they would want to express. Well, I do now as remember.
Yeah.
The I guess two comments. I thought Brother Brennan's remarks were very, very excellent. On the matter of like this analysis paralysis business, the very fact that Jesus introduces this whole matter of divorce under the banner, if you will, because of the hardness of your hearts. Right away, and Brendan brought this out even in his remarks, but I think it's so important. Right away tells you that don't waste your time trying to furrow into all the minutiae of detail and get lost about what he's trying to say in the interest of the Christian. And one of the points that I think when it says, you know, when they respond to him, you know, how hard, you know, this is awfully hard, you know, how can we possibly do this? He says, well, it's given to those, it's only to those
who
receive it. I think that really is specifically to the Christian. This is to the disciple of Christ. Those are the ones to whom it's given. And it is a higher standard. It is the whole issue of marriage then becomes quite considerably closer to what it was intended to be back in the Garden of Eden. And that's what Jesus is basically trying to illustrate in terms of discipleship and what his ministry is all about. And he even characterizes the ancillary things, you know, well, now you can sin in thought and lust after another in thought and be unfaithful, you know, in a sense, showing that, you know, as a Christian, one has a much higher obligation to try to be in focus with what God's original intent was. And so much of what Jesus says, even in those New Testament citations, it's like, what I say unto you, what I say unto you, what I say unto you. It's a contrast. So trying to justify or trying to find a loophole or a way in which one can now, you know, look upon a Christian, you know, another, you know, second marriage that had no legitimate basis, you know, scripturally, to try to use the Old Testament to reinforce that thinking, I think, really, you know, it's analysis paralysis. You've lost the whole point of what Jesus' ministry is about. Even in the Old Testament, though, in Deuteronomy 24, I think one reality is that divorce and putting away, no doubt from a practical point of view, had been both abused. Because the Jew didn't keep the law perfectly. You know, the high priest didn't necessarily keep the law. High priest plural, even. You know, I mean, showing that there were certain deviations from what, I'll say, the pure law as it was given to Moses was meant to be. There were various...
That happened so quickly.
Yeah, there were various, you know, like deflections, if you will, from the law right from the get-go. So when you look at Deuteronomy 24, it surely was probably misapplied by the Jew historically. But if you look at it carefully, I think you can like contain that those few verses to only certain circumstances where even the writ was meant to be allowed. Not it wasn't meant to be a free-for-all for everything. And one of the hints is in connection where it says if there be any uncleanness found in her, that uncleanness, that word, which is elsewhere translated numerous times as nakedness, in Leviticus 18 and 20, implies familial problems. In other words, where you actually don't, incest, where you shouldn't marry anyone who's like related to you. So I'll say conceivably, I don't know if it was the primary thrust, but conceivably there could be situations, and knowing that these, you know, the back in that those days, they didn't have one or two children. You know, they had broods. that conceivably somebody could find out that they were related in some distant manner, or not distant enough, but that being the problem, that they were
clear. I mean, that whole issue of divorce had clear limitations. And unfortunately, it was it didn't take long because they fought like Egyptians initially, and then it didn't take long for them to deflect and sin, you know, commit harm against God as a nation. And then we have, you know, Assyrian and Babylonian captivities, and then they had all these subsequent rulers, and the Greco-Roman world was very liberal from that perspective. And that's like what you were saying, that these it turned into a debate fest, like every single other point of the law to the Jew, that they would debate the most minuscule, ridiculous facets and come up with a million different scenarios for the one thing. Well, what about this? What if it's turned this way? What if it's upside down? What if it's black? What if it's red? What if it's pink? You know, it's those type of things. And the same thing happened with the marriage, that they said, well, they listed the liberal side of the argument, listed things like she ruined the soup. You can divorce her. She literally, I mean, these are literal things that they came up with. That these things are in the Talmud. These things are in the Jewish writings to this day. So, and then they had the conservative side of the argument that it was only for fornication.
I was going to add, maybe there's a secondary. So I think the whole issue of familial problems was one of the things where that would then be allowed. You know, if you were betrothed, and then somewhere between the time you were betrothed and when you're going to be married, or even if you got married and then all of a sudden you realize that there's a familial situation here that was unknown, then that could be undone. It could be annulled, you know, like in a sense.
And Jesus would support that.
Yeah.
He wasn't going against proper divorce. He was going against the putting away, and that's why he differentiated those words.
Then the other conceivable application to Deuteronomy 24 would be along the lines that if a woman was not a virgin and like led her betrothed to think that she was, that conceivably could be grounds for a divorce. And the reason why I think that's very possible is because in Deuteronomy 22 you have an example of a husband who is fraudulently trying to make that assertion. And it's proved otherwise, and he's the one who pays the penalty and he has to stay in the marriage. But so I think there were, like, it was meant to be used in a very limited sense, but it had, through abuse, become very liberal, divorce, and put away, eventually, you know, like anything went, you know, almost on the putting away side. But they were not You know, so I think the Jew is breaking breaking the law right and left. But Jesus doesn't even really go into much of this. He dismisses some of these arguments almost in a very collective sense in the way he reasons on them. When they try to trick him about the matter of the woman who had the multiple husbands, well, you know, whose husband is she going to be in the kingdom? You know, it's like this is a trick question. And Jesus skips over the entire kingdom age and tells them, like, you fools, don't you know that neither, in the age to come, men will neither marry nor be given in marriage. So he skips over the whole kingdom age and how that process is going to be unraveled, because it will have to be unraveled. But he goes to what the intent is. The intent in the ages to come is that they're not going to marry. So he responds to that answer, in a very unusual way, and he responds to the arguments that the scribes and Pharisees are doing in an almost like equally different way.
And he makes it intentionally plain. He doesn't
go into all these minutia.
Because he knows that they'll get swept up in it.
Yeah.
And we do as brethren, even to the, we get caught up very easily, because Satan loves to do that. That's that whole, the three B's, the distractions and the delusions and the deceptions, that the closer we look at the microscopic view, we lose, the macroscopic perspective. And a lot of times, certainly you need both, I think, but you can't sacrifice one at the expense of the other. So, again, with this whole, like you're saying, that really the simplicity boils down, if you just read it, very few people can come out with the conclusion that that means that the adulterer, adultery makes free.
That's the part that's very dangerous. Now, Marie, I think you had your hand up first.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to ask, though. I wanted to ask this during your talk so badly that it's inappropriate to go, wait, before you go on, I'm going to miss the whole thing if I don't get this. And obviously I didn't get to hear it all, but putting away, that's actually, is that just abstinence? Is it sending them away from the house, or is it not allowing them out of the house?
It's separation. That's what it is.
So
it's
kicking them out.
The modern day is separation. Yeah. It's not a legal.
But not even a legal separation.
Right.
It's
okay.
Illegal separation, right, in a sense. Yeah.
And the part two of my question is, now, a lot of what you brought up was from the Old Testament. Is that because a lot of the rationale that we're hearing out there is based on the Old Testament, which shouldn't really apply that much to us, except for an example anyway?
This particular thing that we were addressing is. I'll use it since it's not being recorded.
Yes, it is.
Oh. Rethink words. Well, actually, I don't know. It's one of these things I don't think you can pull. I just don't think you can pull. It's not a, there's no, by no stretch of the imagination, it's funny because we're dealing with groups of brethren and ecclesias, and we're dealing with also simultaneously individual brethren. And this particular elder, who I truly love, he was a big influence initially in my consecration. We spent a lot of time together, and he's an example through and through. On many different levels. Unfortunately, I just think this is a blind spot. We all have them on some issues, but the only problem is that as an elder teaching this and speaking out with this, to ecclesias, even other than his own, is causing a real issue, is potentially causing a real problem, not just with this particular viewpoint. Now, it's an insidious thought, not being intentionally deceptive, but it's an insidious thought in that the line of reasoning or thinking that they base this on is what I think is scripturally very flawed, and teaching men to do so is, heaping more on culpability on the particular individual as well as those who, because they're, setting people up for a fall in a sense. And ultimately, if you draw the conclusion to its finality, you come to the conclusion that adultery is your ticket to freedom of remarriage. And that's the only ticket you can get. That the ones who divorce, if they remarry, they commit adultery, they're free. So when you read that scripture, and Jesus says, you know, he who divorces and marries another commits adultery, he who marries her commits adultery, that and causeth her to commit adultery. So there's adultery all the way around on everyone's part that gets divorced and remarried. But that's also what gives them the freedom to remarry, is that adultery. Now,
under the flawed thinking.
Under the flawed thinking. Yeah, thanks for
clarifying that.
Yeah, but so that's a very serious issue. Now, I will say, because I don't want to that, you know, this particular elder and people, no one that I've spoken with or that's involved in this, to my understanding, condones adultery, believes it's good, they believe it's very bad. This particular elder believes that, you know, you very well may lose your crown, if not worse, by committing adultery, and that you pay for it basically in the next life, as it were, but not in this life. God recognizes the remarriage of an adulterer. He condones the remarriage just as he did, in a sense, the first marriage, and that the church has no authority, even though that's not a verbatim statement, but you have to draw that conclusion. The church has no authority to act. If God recognizes it and condones it, then obviously the church has no authority but to accept the remarried individual.
In short, though, to answer Maria's question, yes, the argument really relies upon that Old Testament.
Right.
Deuteronomy 24.
The definition of divorce, yeah, meaning a separation, a freeing of both parties to remarry. Yeah. And that Jesus is keeping it in that vein, that both parties that are the put away, and the put away one as well as the one that put away for fornication, that's now they're in that same context of Deuteronomy 24, they're both freed because Jesus did not change the meaning of divorce. It was stated that he changed the penalty for divorce, but he did not, and that you can't get that from that scripture. You can't get that from that scripture either, because the Deuteronomy scripture is exclusive of adultery. Exclusive. Does not include in any way, shape, or form adultery. Because, again, the letter of the law, not the practice of the law,
right,
which is very, very important to grab a hold of that. The words are what's important, not the practice, just as in the Christian church. It's Jesus' words, not the... And Jesus even said to the scribes and Pharisees, do what they say, not what they do. So that's the important part. If you grab a hold of the words, you see that adulterers were put to death, male or female, both, and that the Deuteronomy scriptures do not apply to adultery, that there's a difference between putting away and divorce, and that it shows, I think, brings it into the New Testament scripture that Jesus is making that same very same exception, that the putting away, save for the cause of adultery, because both in the type as well as the antitype, it's a death, in a sense. Because really, if you lose your crown, it's that even if there is a potential for restoration on the part of an adulterer or adulteress, losing the crown, I think, you can picture that as death. Granted, there's another level, obviously, of second death, we know, and Jesus makes that extrapolation right in those very same context of Gehenna. He uses the word twice, Gehenna. The one who, you know, you refer to your brother as a fool, etc., can be in danger of hellfire. But with regard to this divorce and remarriage issue, it's you have to keep properly keeping it in tune with or in line with the Old Testament words of the law. Jesus changes nothing. He doesn't change definitions, doesn't change penalties, doesn't change the law, but he clarifies it that you have, you know, for your hard hearts, etc., that it was not Adam and Eve going all the way back. That's the real picture, the Adam and Eve. Jesus and the church, the second Adam and the second Eve, that's the real picture.
Yeah.
And outside of that, it doesn't matter whether men violate it or not. It doesn't matter. That's okay, on a personal level, sure, that's happened more often than it has not happened. But it doesn't change the picture. It doesn't change the picture. It's irrelevant.
Now,
Denise? Actually, you pretty well covered it. The thing that bothers me the most, and I'm sick at heart over that, is that this kind of thing, perverseness is being taught from the platform from a, by an elder to those who may not dig into it, that are being led astray to these kind, with this kind of thing, may be right to be wrong. And I go back to Adam
wrong
Eve.
To be right. Yeah.
Wrong to be right.
Yeah, you know, I think that's just, yeah.
But I go back to Adam and Eve, too. And, you know, it's just sickening.
Yeah, well, it obviously is a serious matter. The Lord will record it all. The one other point I was just going to make mention of is that whole porneo, fornication versus adultery. But porneo is like a generic, more of a generic term.
Right.
And even Paul, in connection with his admonition to the Corinthian church,
uses
porneo, yeah.
Right. But in other places, he does use the apostasis.
Yeah.
So I don't think porneo is not adultery.
That's right.
I think it includes adultery.
As a clarification, I don't think you elaborated on it.
Well, I wish, I could have easily gone. There were more things I would have wanted to bring up, especially, and I didn't get into it in the discourse. I wish I planned it better and had a little more time. But the church's not only responsibility, but right, if you want to call it that, as far as the handling of the matter.